Finance and Revenue is open. Good afternoon, everyone. We are going to hear a public hearing on Senate Bill 211. Today, Senate Bill 215 is not ready today, so we will not do a work session on that. And Senate Bill 718 is a technical change sought by the Oregon Tax Court. And what I'd like to do is hold a work session and vote on that. You can give us a quick rundown, Chris. Let me open up a work session on Senate Bill 718.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This bill expands the establishment of proof of filing with the Oregon Tax Court to include methods beyond the U.S. Postal Service, basically accounting for other delivery mechanisms like UPS and FedEx.
Okay. We're in a work session, Senator Burns.
There's no amendments. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 718 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Benz moves Senate Bill 718 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Boquist?
Yes.
Senator Riley?
Yes.
Senator Taylor?
Aye.
Vice Chair Benz?
Yes.
Chair Hass?
Hass votes yes. Measure passes. Senator Boquist, would you carry that bill?
Delighted.
We close the work session on 718 and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 211. Kyle, this is yours. This was, just to set the stage for Kyle, to set the stage for that bill, part of the so-called grand bargain tax cut for S-Corps and partnerships. And in my opinion, we made some mistakes when we did that by not putting up the proper sideboards. And what this bill seeks to do is put in the sideboards used by the federal government when they passed their pass-through tax break in 2017. The language doesn't exactly mirror the federal language just because the way they write laws and the way LC writes laws. But that's the intent on the caps and the restrictions. Kyle?
Okay, Mr. Chair. Yes, Senate Bill 211, we do have the dash one amendment, and that's what I'll be discussing right here. And so I actually put together, it's a like nine or so slides actually, called the SMS explanation, and that's in the media materials, just to try to walk the committee through what the dash one is doing. Get that pulled up here. But so the dash one amendment is making, as you were describing, making two changes to Oregon's reduced rate policy for pass-through income and also sole proprietors as well, which are included there. And the two changes are really, the first one has to do with lowering the point at which the more standard 9.9% our top personal income tax rate becomes applicable. I have a slide on this in a second, go through in a little more detail. And the second change is tying the types of entities and the income associated with those, so the pass-through entities, the S-Corp, the partnership, aligning that with the federal 20% deduction that was recently enacted, what entities are allowed to take that deduction at the federal level, aligning that with those entities here in Oregon would then be allowed to take Oregon's reduced rates. So in a sense, you can kind of think of it as those entities that are disallowed at the federal level would then be disallowed here in Oregon for Oregon's reduced rate policy. So I do have a couple slides in the meeting materials that's just hitting on some of the high points of Oregon's reduced rate policy. I'll step through those and just go to the changes for now. And then if there's any questions, we can hit on some of the existing policy. But so the rate adjustment that's in the dash one, again, the rates that we have in place right now, that Oregon has in place right now, the reduced rates, there's a 7%, a 7.2, 7, 6, 8, 9, and 9.9% rate based upon the taxable income. And the 9.9% rate kicks in at this non-passive income that's over $5 million. So the change in Senate Bill 211 with the dash one is applying that 9.9% rate beginning at $415,000 and above.
That's a nice chart. Let's see if we can get that up on the screen. It's under materials.
Okay. the meeting materials explanation, I think is what I titled it as.
Dash one, SMS explanation.
Explanation, yeah. Okay. All right, and then we're, it's slide number six. Okay. So what you have up on the screen now is we have the existing rates is in the top box there, which is showing the taxable incomes. This is the non-passive income and the reduced rates that are received on the program in current law today. And those are the 7% all the way up to the 9.9% at the $5 million and above for the income. And then, as I was saying, the Senate Bill 211 with the dash one is it's leaving the first bracket alone, the 7% bracket, and then it begins the 9.9% rate at $415,000. So the second bracket essentially becomes $250,000 to $415,000 is at 7.2%, and then everything above 415 is at 9.9. So the key thing to keep in mind there is for an entity or for a taxpayer that has this non-passive income, the first $415,000 is at those two reduced rates, and then the amount above that is taxed at the 9.9. So it is a marginal rate. So you still get a benefit if you have $1 million in this non-passive income. The first $415,000 would be getting those two, the 7% and then the 7.2% reduced rate. So there is still a benefit for taxpayers that have income above those amounts. It's just reducing the amount of income that's subject to reduced rates, so to speak. The table to the right, still on slide number six, is showing this is some information on the non-passive income that we have for tax year 2017, and it's really showing a distribution of that non-passive income, or the total amount of the qualifying income in the non-passive income category. So the general idea is here is just stepping through the very first row there, about 1% of all qualifying income for this reduced rate policy is from taxpayers that have less than $25,000 of such income. So at the very bottom of this table, I included for those taxpayers with the non-passive income less than $415,000, it represents about 40% of all the qualifying income for the reduced rate policy we have. And so again, individuals or taxpayers that have income above that amount will still get the benefit of the two reduced rate brackets, but the amount above the 415 is then subject to that 9.9% that much earlier under the dash one.
Can you explain that a little? Can you elaborate on that a little bit more? Or maybe just slow it down, go mm-hmm. through it again. This is the proposal under dash one. And this would still 40% of the people or pass-throughs would still be getting a reduced rate.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. So the way Oregon's reduced rates work is it's the pass-through income comes from the entity, the partnership or the S corp, and then it's the taxpayer, so whoever's receiving that income, is then receives the benefit of the reduced rates, and so. Another way to think of it is about 40% of all the qualifying income that's out there right now is unaffected by these rate changes because okay. they're from taxpayers with this non-passive income less than $415,000.
Does that mean that 60% would be?
Yes.
So,
yeah.
So that's what I'm trying to say. But that, you're not saying that 60% of the benefit goes to people making over $415,000.
Not quite. It's 60% of the qualifying income goes to folks making over $415,000. So it does align in some ways to what you just said. Yeah, it's not quite an apples to apples there, but yes, that is true.
I don't know if you went past these slides before they were up, but if we go back to the slide four, claimants. I think that slide down on the bottom right shows what you said and what some of the critics of this policy maintain is that this skews to the higher end when the policy decisions were being made 5 years ago. This wasn't the category we were most interested in helping as much as it was, you know, smaller business people.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and we do have more information on this that I can make available as well. But yeah, right now we do see more of the benefit is going to taxpayers that have a higher level of this non-passive income. That is true, yes.
Have you broken those down to the extent that you can on who, what occupations, professions those are?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I actually have a slide later on that I'll get to that. That's
okay.
Kind
Sorry.
Of change part two. Yeah. But yeah.
But this is a very telling couple of graphs here. For Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Hess. So I just wanted to, I think we discussed this, maybe I forgot. So if you can help me out, Kyle, when we discussed this in the previous session, how does it work when filing and you combine it with, say, another income? So if, so the person just has a quote unquote regular job and, or, you know, a spouse, or can you remind me please how that works?
Yeah, Senator Taylor, the way in which I've tried to frame it in my own mind is you almost have two calculations. So you have the standard calculation on the income tax return, whether you have wage income and you apply your deductions and everything along those lines. And then what the reduced rates did is you're essentially taking this non-passive qualifying income and you pull it off the return. So in that way, it kind of reduces your income that's subject to the standard Oregon rates on the standard return. And then you apply these other reduced rates to that income, and then you combine those two figures together to come to your kind of sum total of tax. And that's the way a taxpayer would have to kind of compute this as well, is because these rates, they're set up where you can opt in. It's not a requirement that you opt into this approach, because depending upon a taxpayer's return, when you choose to elect to take the reduced rates, you do give up your deductions related to that income. If you have other income on the return, you can continue to use your deductions to offset, say, your wage income or a spouse's wage income or something to that effect. But there could be it may not be beneficial necessarily to opt into these rate reductions. So the taxpayer has that ability to choose whether or not to use them.
Follow up, please.
Follow up.
Thank you, Chair Hess. However, when filing, if it's a married couple, would they need to be filing jointly, or could they file independently of each other, and then one is benefiting from some of the options of having the deductions?
Yes, Senator Taylor, I think in most cases you're going to benefit by filing jointly, because in that way you get to use the reduced rate for the non-passive income, and then you can still use your deductions to offset to the spouse's income that's a more standard income and not non-passive income. So you're better off keeping that return combined so you can use your deductions on sort of the income that's not from this pass-through entity, and then you can use the reduced rates on your pass-through income.
And then follow up, and then if the couple both have income through these means, it's going to be very beneficial to them.
Yeah, Senator Taylor, again, that's where it's going to depend upon the taxpayer, and they run through this calculation. There's kind of a chart set up when they're filing, so it's going to depend upon their individual circumstances, certainly, whether or not it helps them more or less to opt in.
Okay. I know you need to finish your presentation. Senator Brokers, did you have
No, thank you.
Comment?
Okay. No, thank you.
Go ahead, Kyle.
Okay. Sarah
Banks. Yeah, so my understanding had been that we would have had far more participation but for that loss of those deductions. And thus, we have a very modest participation at the numbers below 400,000. And then because you're losing your deductions anyway, people began to opt in as you went over it. And thus, this was benefiting those at the higher end more than ever at the lower. So the real question is, once we reduce this, is anybody going to use it by virtue of that loss of deductions, or has that whole geography changed by virtue of the new federal law?
Yeah, Senator Benz, that's an excellent point, because that is one of the cases. As you have more income that's being applied to the reduced rates, that kind of increases your potential benefit there. And again, when we've looked at or just even working through what type of returns are the most likely to benefit, it's again goes back to that return that has maybe some more standard income, so to speak, like wage income, and also has this non-passive income, because then they're really not giving up anything on their deduction side because they can still use that on their other income. So it changes the dynamic a bit on who may benefit, yes.
Wait, the follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Of course, the issue is those people that don't have more than the $400,000 number, that's the question. Does it do any good for those people below that number? I'm not talking about those who might exceed it by virtue of that excess be able to use their deductions. I'm talking about those below that number. Does this, I'm just curious if the loss of the ability to use your deductions if you make less than $400,000 moots the value of this arrangement that we're now contemplating.
Yeah, Senator Bence, could definitely mock something up that would have, if you're just a standard deduction,
yes,
and then
that's what, that's
something
exactly,
like that,
that's
yeah.
That's
we could come with where the threshold
that's
is.
That's the question, thank you.
Certainly, right. Yeah. So I think I'll actually move past this one and let it digest for a second, move on to the second part, the second change, and then we can come back to it if there's questions from the committee, certainly. But the second change in the dash one is, again, aligning, more or less leveraging some of the IRC definitions related to this 20% deduction that was put in place by the Tax Cut and Jobs Act. But in that 20% deduction at the federal level, again, there's this categorization, more or less, between those entities, whether it's, it could be an S-Corp or partnership, that are a specified, specified service trade or business, and those that are not. And while at the federal level, it's bifurcated, they take into account the income of the taxpayer and such. What's being done with Senate Bill 211 with the dash one is just to use that specified service trade or business delineation and apply that here in Oregon. So if the pass-through entity is a specified service trade or business, then that income that gets passed through to the taxpayer would not be applicable to Oregon's reduced rate. So it would essentially exclude certain entities from participating in Oregon's reduced rate policy. Now, I did include the slide that's up on the screen is the IRC definition. That's what's being pointed to in the dash one of Senate Bill 211. So it is using that IRC language and the definitions that go along with it. There's definitely reasons to leverage the federal definitions. But it could be no different than if Oregon put that exact language into Oregon's statute. That is a way forward as well. But you don't get some of the benefits, I suppose, of connecting to the federal language. But I think the chart on slide number 9 is probably the most helpful in trying to visualize what the changes are. So the table that you see there is, again, this is building off of the tax year 2017 data that we have. And this is for e-filers, so it's a subset of the data, but it's pretty good representation. And it shows the amount of this non-passive income by the NAICS sector. So again, a NAICS sector is kind of the description of the type of business and what sector it belongs with. So the first one is sector code 11, and that'd be businesses associated with agriculture, forestry, fishing, and hunting. And I've highlighted, or what's shaded in green on the screen, are those sectors that are going to align with the specified service trade or business sector identified at the federal level that would be excluded, is the idea. So if you're shaded in green, those are the types of businesses that would not be able to participate in Oregon's reduced rate benefit, so to speak. And it's not necessarily a one-size-fits-all. So if you're in, say, the professional, scientific, and technical services sector, it doesn't mean every single business that fits within that NAICS code is excluded, but that's the general sector that gets caught by this. So it doesn't necessarily grab the whole category, because that's not how the definition, and that's not how the language was developed in the IRC, but it does highlight these are the areas, the sectors that would be touched upon that have businesses within them. If I include on the last slide, is this comes from an IRS publication that actually has the specified service trade or business, and then it describes these are the instructions for filing your taxes at the federal level, it describes in a little more detail what type of entities are included there. So that's worth looking at as well. It'll give you a little more indication of what's the type of business, not just simply it's finance and insurance, but a little bit more of what is going to be excluded here.
Well, it looks like it ticks out about a third of your categories from slide 9. Is that translate to a third of the revenues, or how does that equation work out?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, because it grabs not the entire category necessarily, a rough figure is about 20% of the overall income. And again, it's not necessarily because it's 20% of the overall income doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be exactly 20% of the revenue impact, but in terms of just to give you a rough number, that's about what it would be pulling out as well. Again, it's where you are on the rates and how much benefit you get between the two, but yeah, in terms of an order of magnitude quick estimate, give you a sense of it, that 20% figure works fairly well. And again, one thing I should mention on the sector table, that doesn't overlay the changes to the rates as well. So putting those two together also interconnects on how the revenue impact actually falls out. So this is viewing it compared to the current law and not after we've put in the new rates beginning at $415,000. So there'll be some interconnection between the two.
Maybe you had this on your slides and I missed it, but what is the current law cost to the Treasury for this program? And what would that be reduced by on the dash ones?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, right now, so back on slide number 4, the revenue impact for tax years 2016 and 17, so that's the two most recent years we have data on. This is for the full year filer, so you see it's about $95 million in both 16 and 17. That's a bit over $100 million for when we include not just the full year filers, but also part years and non-residents as well. But in terms of like a rounded number, you're talking about $100 million per tax year. And right now, the initial indication of the runs we've done, making the changes in SB 211 with the dash one would be about a $60 million revenue impact each year going forward. So that'd be the lift there.
Okay. What about $100 million current law per year?
Yes. Yeah. And so the 60 million is actually out, I think, 1 year. So it's a bit over half is kind of one way to think of it as well.
This $66 million, is that the amount that we're spending now on claimants over $500,000?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Yeah, that's the reduced taxes for those. Yeah.
So of the $100 million, $95 million, $66 million goes to claimants over $500,000.
Yes, that's correct.
Senator Taylor? Senator Boquist? We do have some people signed up to testify. Let's start with John Calhoun and Jody Weiser. On the dash ones.
Good afternoon, Chair Haas, Vice Chair Bentz, and members of the committee. My name is John Calhoun, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Coalition of Christian Voices. I support the objective of SB 211, but I believe that the limits it is proposing are still too high. We do not believe the legislature should be aiding the wealthy while reducing resources that could be used to help the poor, sick, and vulnerable. SB 211 reduces the eligibility for the lower pass-through rates, as we've discussed. Clearly, this is an improvement from the current statute from our faith perspective. The -1 amendment further improves this law, and we applaud this addition. The questions I ask, however, are why shouldn't the cutoff for this tax benefit be lower than $415,000? Why should business owners earning more than $415,000 get the discounted rates on their first $415,000, which I believe is the case? What is it that the reduced rates are set to accomplish? In 2017, as you pointed out, 99% of the discounted benefits go to taxpayers with incomes greater than $100,000. Two-thirds go to people with incomes over $500,000. In the 2018 special session, additional businesses were added, sole proprietors, so that's going to change it slightly, but not a great deal. In 2017, the median Oregon household income was $60,000. However, the top 1% of household incomes begins at $359,000. This means that the limit in SB 211 will still benefit the top 1% of Oregon taxpayers. $359,000 is close to seven times the median Oregon household income. So I ask you why you continue to provide pass-through business owners who are amongst the wealthiest Oregonians lower tax rates than the janitors on minimum wage that clean their buildings. This is immoral and violates the tenets of my faith and my American sense of fairness. Take from the poor and give to the rich. If this lower rate is revised, I suggest that you consider the cutoff in terms of multiples of the Oregon median household income. Two times, maybe even three times, but certainly not seven times. I also think that whatever limit is chosen to be a hard cutoff, that is, the taxpayer that has income above the limit should not be eligible for any discount. As it stands, and as currently written, those with million-dollar incomes will continue to get the lower rates on the first $415,000 of their income. What's the sense of that? Most of you know that I spent nearly 50 years in business, including 25 years in small business as an owner and financial executive. I can assure you that when I was an active partner in an LLC, I would certainly have enjoyed paying a lower rate, but it would have had nothing to do with the business. The few thousand additional dollars that would have come to me wouldn't change how many employees we had or what capital we purchased. Even though this tax rate has been in effect for several years now, there is no study that I'm aware of that says it provides any economic benefit to the state. It's time to reform this tax break for the wealthy. If it is to continue, at a minimum, limit the benefits to those whose incomes are closer to the hardworking, barely surviving entrepreneurs that are used to justify this tax expenditure.
Thank you, Jody. Chair Hass and members of the committee, Jody Weiser speaking for Tax Fairness Oregon. We're glad that you're working on this employer's tax break. We used to call it the pass-through tax break, but now I guess it's really the employer's tax break. And we think that the -1 amendment is a significant change in the right direction. But like John, we're bothered by the fact that we're still giving the benefit to very wealthy people for no apparent reason. If you set Oregon's corporate tax rates to be exactly what people pay, then you would take away any of the reasoning that was there when we created this tax break in 2013. People who are doing business as pass-through entities were paying a higher tax rate than corporations. Well, if corporations pay what we're paying, then we don't need to lower the pass-through rate, because everybody's paying the same amount. If the legislators, so we believe you should get rid of it entirely, but if you're unwilling to end the tax break entirely, or if there's polling that clearly indicates that leaving something there for small business owners is seen positively by voters, then we think the new limits of $207,000 for single filers and $415,000 for joint filers still provides benefits to the top people in our state. It's not right. It's not right that people who are barely making it are paying higher taxes on lower amounts of income than people who are employing them. But if you propose to keep the tax break, we think the taxable income limits should be no more than 2 times the median household income in the state. Now that would be about $120,000. Of course, you would want to index it for inflation, and it should be a hard limit. So anybody that makes $230,000 would not be eligible for the tax break. And we would consider a rate change. Under our current law, we actually are providing a greater tax benefit for people on their income between $250,000 and $415 than we are for people whose income is lower than $250. And so we would suggest a 7% rate for those with income under $40,000, a 7.5% rate for those with income under $80,000, and an 8% rate for those with income under $120,000, with no rate reduction for those with income over $120,000. While this still advantages business owners over employees, at least it focuses the benefits on those who have small taxable incomes and leaves the general fund with the assets to provide education, human services, public safety, health care, and economic development for those employers and for all other Oregonians. These changes would give you significantly more income, and it would decrease the excesses of the 2013 legislation. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you, John, Jody. Smith and J.L. Wilson.
Good afternoon, Chair Haas, members of the committee. For the record, Anthony Smith, Oregon State Director for NFIB, representing thousands of small businesses across the state, many being the smallest of small businesses. I'll start off with addressing some of the technical changes provided by the Dash Ones, which I think are a good thing. There was some confusion and some language on the second page specifically of the bill that was introduced that was problematic as to whether or not Congress would reauthorize Section 199 Cap A. And so the clarity that the Dash One provides, I think, achieves the desired impact that the committee was going for in introducing Senate Bill 211. That being the case, we still have problems with the bill and would still oppose Senate Bill 211, even amended by the Dash Ones, for a number of reasons. And Mr. Chair, you mentioned the grand bargain. And you can still find in OLIS House Bill 3601 from that special session. But that bill wasn't just a bill to create a small business tax cut. In fact, if you look at the revenue impact statement for that bill, it's a bill to raise revenue, and it required the requisite 3/5 supermajority to pass that bill because it made some significant changes to our corporate tax structure. And then there were some other things, senior medical deduction and other things that were included, but that was a bill for raising revenue. Which gets me to my point here on Senate Bill 211, even with the Dash Ones. This bill will raise revenue, and without, to me, in my opinion, a clear policy objective as to justify the tax increase on certain taxpayers, in my view, that is a bill for raising revenue, and we have certain constitutional requirements in place for how we go about passing bills for raising revenue. Another thing I would probably mention is at the time that this policy was implemented, LRO did some projecting of what the program would cost in terms of cost to the Treasury. And the program has actually performed exactly as it was intended. In fact, the first year or so, I think it was 2015, was the first year that the program was in effect, and we were way under budget as far as what the tax expenditure was to the state. In the subsequent years, 2016, 2017, it's been right under $100 million, and that's right on target. There were sideboards in place that are still in current law that would have triggered LRO to adjust some rates if the program were to, you know, spin out of control and a bunch of taxpayers were taking advantage of it. We would have gone back and we would have looked at that, and we would have had those sideboards in place, but those weren't triggered by the actual amounts of revenue that, well, the amount of tax dollars that were saved by taxpayers as a result of this program. I'll wrap it up, but I just want to put on the record that there is a House bill. I mean, we're talking about Senate Bill 211, but there is a House bill that has bipartisan support that gets at this issue a little bit different. And so we haven't taken a position on that bill yet, but we're going to be engaging our members and seeing if they're interested in a more nuanced approach to how we might reform this policy. And if that's the desire of the chair and the committee for us to be engaged in that dialogue, then we would be happy to do that. But at this point, if we're talking about Senate Bill 211 with the dash ones, we would be opposed. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Chair Haas. Members of the committee, for the record, J.L. Wilson, representing the Oregon State Chamber of Commerce. We would oppose Senate Bill 211 and even with coupled with the dash one amendment. I have a personal connection to this law. I remember sitting in this position with you 6 years ago during the grand bargain.
It takes lobbyists out of this. Yeah,
oh, I know. But the good news is I'm a C Corp. I have a personal connection because my testimony then in 2013 is the same as now. And the reason I felt that this was such a viable, good policy for small business is that the lifeblood of small business is retained earnings and cash flow. And if you don't have that, you don't have anything. And any tax policy that enabled or enhanced those things was a good policy, in our opinion. And obviously that we prevailed, and that was coupled with an increase in the C-Corp tax rate. That rate was increased from 6.6 to 7.6 on income between $1 and $10 million. And so I don't think you can revisit the pass-through discussion without revisiting the C-Corp, because they were clearly coupled in that short session. But having said all that, we are certainly not opposed to revisiting the specifics of this policy. Anthony alluded to House Bill 2743 on the House side. I'd probably be a little more bold and say I think we're probably closer to supporting a policy like that. And I know it doesn't gain the state any revenue. It's more revenue neutral in its impact. But, we've never felt that we weren't wedded to this concept that it had to apply to income up to $5 million. If you wanted to reduce the cap, I think that was a good policy choice, and expanding, on the flip side, expanding it out to increase and capture more small businesses. We did it with sole proprietors. We can do it by loosening the employee work hour thresholds. That was a perfectly legitimate policy option too, and one that I think that we could be supportive of. So it's just a long way of saying wouldn't support this particular concept, but would support a discussion that includes reshaping it, and could probably support a bill that reshapes it. And to Senator Bence's point about would people take advantage of this under 400,000, clearly we have 18,000 of the 22,000 people who capitalize on this today are above that half or below that $500,000 threshold. And so I think there's plenty of incentive, and it still could be an effective policy for small business, even if you wanted to lower the cap. And so we would be fine with that discussion, and may even support a bill like 2743 on the House side.
Yeah. I appreciate both of your engagement on this. I guess I'm just looking at that sometimes maligned Federal Tax Act that was criticized for being rushed and language written in the margins, that even as rushed as it was, it's still on the pass-through tax break managed to put in caps and some restrictions on keeping, you know, professionals out of it. So.
Thank
and we
you.
Just tried to mirror that.
Chair Haas, but didn't we disconnect from that piece? I mean, I thought we did.
But the point is, they use the same. They have the foresight to say we've got to put in these protections.
I gotcha.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I would just like to get on the record that under the Section 199 Cap A rules, those specified service trade or business organizations, pass-through businesses that might qualify for that 20% federal deduction, they still get that 20% deduction up until $315,000, and then it starts to phase out up to $415,000. So if you are one of the specified trade or businesses that Senate Bill 211 with the dash ones is essentially saying no to the policy, those folks still would get qualify for the federal deduction if their income was under that certain threshold of $315,000 to $415,000. So that is a key difference between the federal deduction and what Senate Bill 211-1 would do.
Okay, thank you for that.
Questions?
Thank you.
Daniel Hauser.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, excuse me. Thanks for letting me come in here a little bit late to the sign-up. I really wanted to express, and will do so as briefly as possible, the importance in understanding how this policy affects the difference between the owner of a business and the employees of the business. To make this as clear as possible, a janitor working for a business owned by, let's say, a S corporation would be paying a higher tax rate on much of their income than the business owner's paying on hundreds of thousands of dollars in income. Now, I appreciate the Dash One amendments and what the Senate bill does in scaling back that tax subsidy for the profits of business owners, but it's simply not enough. We shouldn't have in our tax code, at a time of historic inequality, at a time when we have homeless throughout our state struggling to stay warm and stay housed, a policy that spends tens of millions of dollars subsidizing just the profits of these pass-through business owners. And so I would certainly encourage this committee to go further and to eliminate this policy. And if not, this bill certainly is a step in the right direction. The, what was it, $40 million, I believe, a year-ish that this would raise in revenue. And correct me if I'm wrong, Kyle or anyone, but that's still a lot of money that could go to really important services helping Oregonians. And I think that even that step is important, but I would certainly encourage this committee to eliminate this policy. So with that.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. More to come on this. That clears our agenda. We have a revenue forecast coming up next Wednesday. I should put that on your calendar. Wednesday morning, here in Room A.
Riveting.
8:30. And that will be in lieu of the afternoon Senate Revenue Committee. Okay. With nothing further, we are adjourned.